The primo seats are in the front, so if you feel like you are able to move to the front, that would be very nice indeed. I'm Alfred Conklin. I teach chemistry and soils at Wilmington College in Wilmington, Ohio, and I've done that for a number of years. Oh. Actually, I didn't want it to do that. Oh, okay. That's a part I didn't develop. I could start out by talking about Langmuir when he was born and go through his high school, his college, etc. We could do all of that. That's not what I'm going to do this morning. What I'm going to do this morning is I'm going to talk about the scientific situation before Langmuir developed his equation. So in order to do that, you need to put everything that you know about science on hold, or don't forget about it because you need to remember all that, but sort of suspend what you know, and we're going to go back in time, don't close your eyes, I don't want you to go to sleep, back in time. And what was going on in 1916, 1915, in that time period? What was going on? What did people know? Where was the research? Why did it take Langmuir that long to come up with the equation? I'm glad he did, and it's great, and it's helpful, but what took that long to get there? So we're going to talk about Langmuir films first. And this is really what led into the equation. And he was very interested in films and single layers of atoms and what was happening to those single layers at the time. Now, in 1950, people were still trying to find holes in these layers so that things like potassium could get through to the inside of the cell. So, you know, it's quite a few years went into the research to find all of these things. So I just put this up for a minute. He won a lot of prizes. I'm sure you'll see this again. But we're down here before 1918 talking about what was going on. So I'm bringing up two avenues of investigation. Oil on water is one, and the other is ion exchange. And oil on water had been known for a long time, and ion exchange was still sort of a mystery, I think, in this time period. So if we put oil on water, then we would expect that the hydrophilic portion would be associated with the water molecules, and the hydrophobic portion would not. And so we'd have these molecules randomly dispersed over the surface of the water. And so this is very low concentration, obviously. So then we've got the hydrophilic part is in the water, the hydrophobic part is sticking up, oftentimes in the range of 10 to 16 or 18 hydrocarbon chain, and it's sticking up out of the water. Now, obviously, there must have been some attraction between the acid functionality of these acids and the water molecule itself. However, there's a little surprise in a minute here about that. So there was a lot of research done in which these molecules were brought closer and closer together, and eventually you wind up with a monolayer of the hydrophobic portion above the hydrophilic portion, which was always on water. There is a video on YouTube about oil calming water. It's a very interesting video. It gives no information about the size of the water puddle or lake or how much oil they put on it, but you can go to YouTube and look at it if you like. Oh, by the way, I wasn't not able to repeat that in the laboratory, so I'm not sure what they did to get that. So anyway, people did a lot of work along this line, invented machines to tell when you had a monolayer, and just did a whole lot of research on this whole area of monolayers. And as I said, Langmuir was interested in monolayers. He was interested in this type of thing. So if we watch this for a second, and I chopped it down, this is what happens when you put oil on water. And probably none of you can do this. I almost couldn't do this demonstration because we got rid of all of our chalkboards, and it turns out that chalk dust works really good for doing this demonstration. So I had to find a colleague with some chalk and a chalkboard and make some chalk dust so I could put this on the water and then put a drop of oil on it. By the way, if you use oil out of the store, it'll probably be a slow process. This was used engine oil, and that worked very fast to get this clear area. So you can do this at home. It's not dangerous. Well, anybody can drink too much water and die, so we're at that end of the scale always, too. So one of the things that you can do with this demonstration is you can calculate Avogadro's number. We're not going to do that, but you can get Avogadro's number. So the ideas that we have here is that we've got a monolayer that we've formed, and we've got attraction somehow. But the interesting thing is that at this time, we didn't know about hydrogen bonding. Think about that. I use hydrogen bonding and talk about it all the time. I think it's something everybody ought to know. But at this time, no hydrogen bonding. What was going on? What was the interaction that was happening? Now, let's go back. Sorry about that. One of the things here is that you've got water. And all the water is water molecules. And all the water molecules are the same. So there's no reason why anyone would think that they would try to look at the specific interaction between a specific fat and a specific water molecule. Because all the water molecules are the same. And so there's no reason to think, why would we have some interaction? We don't know about hydrogen bonding. What's the interaction here that gives us this monolayer? Oh, by the way, if you use the salt of a fatty acid, it'll work better than the fatty acid itself. Okay, so the other thing that was going on, we had done some experiments and people had observed ion exchange, and a lot of times they were working with positive ions. And so part of the soil must be negative, so that's pretty good. But soil is a complex mixture of clays and organic matter, and I'll talk about this later. But at that time, we did know about zeolites, and the advantage that they have for this particular line of thinking is that they have a known molecular structure. So now we can look at this known molecular structure and say, where exactly is the attraction? Okay, the stuff in your lab called molecular sieve 5A and 13A, that's zeolite. And why, where, how, what happens that positive ions would be attracted to zeolites? Moses is supposed to have known about it, so it's, and then Aristotle, and they used it in the Roman aqueducts, and the main thing here at the bottom is that you can make zeolites. They're too expensive to use for most things, but you can construct them and make them. Well, the zeolites, then, we have the structure. So now we've got something that we can really work with, because we've got, and you've seen this before, you've seen it as soil clays. Even if you don't work with them, you've had them in class probably. And so now we've got a structure, and we can identify particular places in that structure which might attract or which will attract ions. And so we've got something to work with. We went from water, where we couldn't really tell which water molecule was associated with what, to something where we could really look at the cation exchange. It was a known structure, and we knew the attraction. So aluminum, again, technically it has a charge of 3. So if you attach another oxygen to it, you get the negative charge, and of course that's going to attract your cations. And that's the way it works in soil too, but I'll talk about that in a minute. So we've got this attraction between our positive cations and the oxygen in the structure of zeolite. And so now we can pinpoint this to try to decide what's really going on. Well, this is what we have as a structure for zeolite. And you have a hole in the center, which is the 5A and 13A, the different sizes of holes. And then you have the aluminosilicate around the outside, and you can begin to study this and determine where the exchange is actually taking place, on what part of the molecule, and exactly what's going on. So here's, you can put the zeolites together and have a bigger structure than you would with the individual zeolites. And there's a lot of different zeolites out there. I don't know how many there are, but there are certainly 20, 40, 50 or so. And as I say, you can synthesize these in the laboratory. Well, when we try to look at our interest, my interest is soils, and when we start look at soils, we can look at just the clay. In soil, of course, you've got organic matter, you've got other things that are attracting cations, but we have the aluminosilicate, and we look at the clays as one-dimensional structures, 1D, and with the zeolites, we have a three-dimensional structure, and it's a very rigid structure to work with. Now, the size of the clays change. Of course, you have a lot of different clays in soil, so the size of the clays change, and that will change the cation exchange capacity. And the water content changes, as you very well know, whether it's a field capacity or less, or saturated for that matter. And here with the zeolites, we can have a specific water content. So we can take water out of the equation and just look at the exchange sites. And then the soil has cation exchange, and we have a sieve characteristic of the zeolites in addition to the cation exchange. So these two things were going on. We knew something about cation exchange. We knew something about layers. And a lot has been learned since then, of course. And when we're looking at soil, just to bring us out a little more, we have clays, and they have cation exchange capacity. We have organic matter, whether it's undecomposed or decomposed or humus. So the question is, where's the cation exchange on clay or soil per se? And so having the zeolite where we had a definite structure, and we could identify different definite positions where we had cation exchange, took us a long way in understanding what was going on with cation exchange. So now we have really two things. We have the interaction of the hydrophobic part of the oil with water, so we know there's some sort of attraction there, and we have a way to identify particular places in a molecule where we have cation exchange. So these two ideas come together, if not directly. I don't know what Langmuir was thinking at the time that he developed his equation, but certainly these ideas were well known to scientists of the time. And they were able to work with them, do a lot of research with them, and identify a lot of what was going on. So the zeolites have a definite structure. We can identify different zeolites. They have both absorption and cation exchange sites, but I was just concentrating on the cation exchange sites. Now, we do use zeolites, or they can be used and have been reported to be used in agriculture, slow release of ammonium, potassium, mostly positive ions, and as a soil amendment to improve soil characteristics. At the beginning, I said that we should go back in time. If you have the opportunity, I would highly recommend watching Mystery of Matter. It's a show put out by PBS. It's on YouTube, but you buy the CD and watch that. It's much better. And I use it in my classrooms all the time. Well, there's a number of references that I can give you. There's the Nobel Prize, and there's some other ones. Those are with the presentation. Ben Franklin, Stilled the Waters, is a good one. It's a book. It's a good one to look at. And the Journal of American Chemical Society and IEEE would be other places to look for information about the Langmuir equation.